More. Today's in terms of inflation for minimum.
Thanks a lot, Rob, for the introduction. Yeah, I would like to speak on the proposal for how to embed inflation into MFI by using multi-factor dynamics. It's a proposal made by Patrick, Melanie Becker, and myself recently, beginning of this year. But I thought it was also, would be also useful to touch on the work which was done with Melanie Becker and Bob Ricorio. So the sketch for this talk is as follows. First, I would like to provide some background of the framework on which I'm working in. In particular, I would like to speak a little bit about heterogeneous M3 flux convectification geometries and its relevance for Newton's constant. And then touch a little bit upon the issue of moduli stabilization in the Sitter vacuum. But since this is not the main focus of my talk, I will be brief and sketchy there. And then come to this proposal of how to embed inflation into M theory and triangle factor dynamics. So first, let me give you some background on the framework in which I'm working, which is heterotic in M-theory. So this is synonymous for M-theory compactified on S1 mod Z2, the simplest orbifold. So you start with the X11 coordinate compactified for the circle, and then you have the identification of X11 with minus X11 under this Z2. So effectively, the circle shrinks together and becomes this interval. At the end of this interval, we have two fixed planes. It's 10-dimensional fixed planes because we have 11-dimensional theory here. So at 0 and at L, we have these fixed planes such that the geometry looks as follows. In the bulk, the 11-dimensional bulk, we have ordinary M theory, which means we have 11-dimensional supergravity plus M theory corrections. And then on the boundaries, these fixed planes, we have each NEA Sipayan-Wills gauge theory. So on the right boundary here, this is supposed to represent us, the visible boundary. And then we have an additional hidden boundary, which is very interesting, for example, for hidden matter, for dark matter, as we'll see later on. Remember, in all this, in this whole talk, I will work in the regime where this L, this polyfold length, is sufficiently bigger than 1 so that we have the story type of regime. But there's this nice relation between the orbifold length L, which is proportional to the spin coupling GS to the 2/3, which means that once we bring both boundaries, we push them on top of each other, we would be back in the weakly coupled hydraulic spring. So when L becomes 0, or the spin coupling becomes very small. The important thing about these boundaries is, as far as the flux compactification backgrounds and geometries are concerned, that these boundaries act as magnetic sources for the four-point field strength G, which means that if you look at the Bianchi identity, then there's an unfigured right-hand side, and this right-hand side is localized on the boundaries. So this is delta function which describes this localization on the boundaries. So the next step, we would like to compactify this theory down to four dimensions to compare to particle physics or four-dimensional cosmology. And this can be done in particular by compactifying an additional cardioid threefold. Actually, also a generalization to a non-scalar manifold would be possible. But for this talk, I will not touch upon that issue. So we would work with an additional compactification of a cardioid threefold. And we have just seen that, in general, it's no longer consistent to set the G equal to 0. So the G would, in general, require that. And the task is, well, what is this warp geometry, or what is this? What does the geometry look like in the presence of this non-vanishing flux? And this was first addressed by Witten in 96, who found an approximate solution to this compactification geometry by using the warp vector as a linear, or as a small parameter, linearize the solution, linear in the warp vector, and had, therefore to assume that the warp vector stays small. So let me right away come to the exact solution for these flux compactification geometries, which is for the simplest type of flux given by this expression here. So you have the warp vector multiplying the external, or in particular this case here, it's the Minkowski external metric, and then you have the inverse warp vector multiplying the external part, sorry, the internal part, consisting of the Clavial manifold, the only fold of these, where the warp vector is for the exact solution given by this expression here, where the X11 is the coordinate along the orbifold, and the Q sub V is the Gödel boundary charge determining the coupling to the C form, to the free form potential. Yes?
This is just this linear potential when you have a correlation one brain.
Yeah. Right, it's exactly like in, well, the ordinary brain solution, what you would expect. It's exactly the same. But that looks one of the consistency checks, actually. Yeah. So, to give you an idea how this warp factor affects the geometry, let me plot the volume. So the volume dependence along the club yaw is now determined by this log factor, which depends on x11. The volume is therefore important because, first of all, it determines the gauge couplings on the visible and on the hidden context. It also determines the Newton's constant in four dimensions, effective Newton's constant, because you have to integrate over the bulk, and so therefore the bulk geometry is important. So, in the exact solution, what you find is that the Calabrial volume varies quadratically or parabolically, so it's this function here. And due to supersymmetry, you run into the zero, so the volume at this point becomes zero. This is, the cause for this is supersymmetry. If you relax supersymmetry, then you would have an additional integration constant, which would in principle allow you to shift this upwards or downwards. So this sounds, first of all, for a person who's educated in GR, probably horrible that you have a volume zero, which actually indicates or actually is related to a naked localized singularity at that point. There's no horizon protecting it. But I would like to remind you that if you go back to the Quinton solution, which you can, which is recovered as the tangent approximation of the full solution at the localization of the whistle boundary, so then the volume decreases in a linear way and comes zero at some point, and after that it goes towards minus negative infinity, and so that is even worse. So in that respect, the improvement is that of this minus negative infinity, or this whole negative region, we have now a remnant left over, which is this localized singularity. So the question is, of course, we are not in GR, we are in M theory, so there are good reasons to expect that higher order corrections, incidental corrections, I do not want to mention explicit regular supersymmetry, which would also be a possibility to predict it, but that these quantum corrections could actually lift the singularity. So this is work currently under study at the group, by a group at Michigan. They include part of the portals and the lifting of the singularity here. For us, for the purpose of this talk, I would like to say that due to the singularity here, what we would like to do is we would like to stabilize the hidden boundary. So here's the visible boundary. We'd like to stabilize the hidden boundary at LC at this critical value or before the critical value. So the question in the end would be, can we stabilize it just on account of the dynamics of the theory? Of course, we do not want to put it in by hand and truncate space off artificially. But let me first point out an intriguing connection to Newton's constant, which was already found by Witten with this approximate background. So you can evaluate just by integrating out over the internal seven dimensions, you can evaluate the effective four dimensional Newton's constant, and it turns out to be lower bounded by some value, and this value here, this critical value, this is exactly the value of Newton's constant once you place the hidden boundary at the place its critical length, so at the place of the naked singularity. So now comes a curious numerical observation, namely, if you assume that on the whistle boundary you have an ordinary gut, which means you have a gut scale of 3 times 10 to the 16 GeV, you have gauge coupling on the whistle boundary, which is 1 to like 25, and you assume that the radius of the Calabrial at the location of the whistle boundary is given by the inverse of the gut scale. And I would like to remind you that here, in hadronic M theory, the gut scale is the 11-dimensional Planck scale. So this is actually the fundamental scale. Yes, this goes under the name of lowering the string scale and has the implication that you can unify the gauge couplings with the gravitational coupling constant. So the 11-dimensional Planck scale is the gut scale here in the hadronic M theory framework. Therefore, under this assumption that the radius of the Calabrial is given by its natural value, and using the gut theory on the whistle boundary, you find for this critical volume, well, this numerical volume over here, and this is a striking agreement with the experimental volume. So therefore, this is a definite clue that what you would like to do, or what you would request from the theory, is, well, can L be stabilized close to its critical volume? So this is one of the questions I will briefly touch upon later, but this is still the introduction or the overview.
Can I just ask a dumb question? How many superchargers are preserved
with
this?
It's n equals 1 in four dimensions.
N equals 1.
Yeah. So I mean, the bulk preserves n equals 2, but the boundary is in addition breaking down to n equals 1. The bulk is, you can think of the bulk theory as only n theory. But the additional orbifolding, you break it down to n equals 1 in four dimensions.
So okay, so you have a numerical coincidence there, or what seems like a numerical coincidence. Now if you lift, if you include the r to the fourth correction, you lift the minimum somewhat, your statement seemed to be implying that if you lift the minimum too much, you will have no way of achieving.
Well, what you would expect is that you lift the minimum to something of the order of the Planck scale, the dimension Planck scale, which is a graph. But this is currently under investigation, so I'm. Mm-hmm.
But if you lift the minimum to m god, can you still is your minimum constant going to be?
Let's look into the regime. I mean, well, okay. What you have to worry about is the god scale actually in this business. The god scale enters with, I think it was cubes. So it's the value of Newton's constant here. The value is quite sensitive to the god scale actually. So when you would take the god scale, something like 6 × 10⁻⁶ GeV here at 3, then it would be off. I think. Well, it's a little less than an order of magnitude. It's something a factor of 6 or so. But still, it wouldn't give this very precise coincidence. So the gut scale is just very important like this. But I would say, for me, what was striking here and what you need to work with in this framework is this harmony, I mean, between the particle physics sector and the gravity sector. So these two sectors apparently speak to each other here. Gut scale, gut values, alpha gut, and then G Newton. We will find another result where these two sectors are in apparent harmony. We'll find it later on.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just another dumb question. You say that every place where the warp factor does the same, that the volume of the Calabi-Yau goes to zero at that place. Well, that therefore means that a ring that's wrapped around that will be massless, tensionless. And so is there any kind of analog of the Enhanson phenomenon that happens?
Very good. Yeah, actually what is important is you can have 5 instantons. I mean, okay, that in theory, so we have membranes on 5 frames, and we can map them around various cycles.
Right. So if you have 5 frames,
so you can have 5 frames.
If you have 5 frames, wraps the Calabi-Yau, and the Calabi-Yau is zero volume. Both wrapped in 5 frames are tensionless at that place.
You will actually see, I will just mention this, because it's not the main focus of my talk, but actually these are 5 frames, precisely because of this reason, that at that point the volume becomes small, so in 5 instantons no longer should be neglected, and have to be taken into account. This is actually very important for the volume boiler stabilization.
That's
but
important.
Something on the next transparency.
This is a question for last transparency for you.
Okay, so maybe I
just wanted to repeat, sure, this straight. Of course, the volume of the Calabi-Yau is shrinking to zero with a special LC. The volume of the Calabi-Yau, what is R? Is R the volume of the Calabi-Yau?
R is the radius of the order, radius of the Calabi-Yau at the point of the visible boundary. So where the volume is still, where the volume is still large, which means it corresponds to this volume.
So when you talk about then stabilizing at the, if you talk about quantum corrections forcing that Calabi-Yau to have some gut scale size at where it would have been zero, you're telling me you're going to, the quantum corrections in this case, or the Hyperbolic corrections, would make this volume essentially flat across the diagram. It starts off roughly gut scale, or it ends up roughly gut scale, not much, even it's a little shallow there.
Yeah, well, one has to see it from these higher order corrections, but
possibly. I just want to make sure I have a picture of it.
Right, yeah. I mean, in the end, I would say that in this picture, there was always the definite hint that. Somehow the quantum mechanics does not completely disentangle here, and we cannot really just focus on the classical analysis. This was always apparent. It started already at that point where you have these boundaries, as opposed to five-dimensional analysis, but in this n-dimensional framework, there are higher orders. If you construct the action level of it, you have these delta function, delta of zero terms here and there. And so you then can think of quantum mechanics smoothing out these boundaries, making them fuzzy. And since this is a problem, if you would like to construct the action along a Noether method at higher orders, it was always apparent that at some point quantum mechanics should kick in and. Okay. Can I proceed on to another question?
I'll wait.
Okay.
Until I see that.
So, yeah, because this is supposed to be an overview, and I would actually. Well, the prime purpose is also to provide, first of all, some background, and on the other hand, to tell you that this is the situation into which we run after inflation, when you stabilize moduli, and so therefore, let me be brief here, this is still not the main part of my talk, but what we have seen is that we would like to come up with the correct Newton's constant, which means that we have to stabilize the orbifold length that is close to this critical value. At the same time, we know that nowadays cosmological data point towards an approximate synthetic universe, and we know that, well, we have to break supersymmetry in addition and stabilize the moduli, well, at best in some realistic, semi-realistic desiderata. So all this, well, can it be approached in this framework? Yes, it can. And first of all, let me just point out to you how we stabilize the various moduli. So the most important modulus for GUnit, at least, is the orbifold thing, this L. And this can be stabilized by two competing non-perturbative things. So you have open membranes sometimes from one boundary to the other. So these are membranes, random-dimension membranes, which have a space-like free cycle, which is composed out of a gene of zero holomorphic two cycle on the Calabi-Yau times the orbifold length. So this gives rise to a repelling force between the boundaries, which you can see from the superpotential if you wish. So this goes like e to the minus t, where t is proportional to L, the orbifold length. And so the larger the orbifold length becomes, the less this contribution becomes. And if you work out the effective potential, then you see this, that this leads to a repelling force. On the other hand side, if you have the hidden boundary not too far away from the place where the volume becomes small, then the hidden gauge theory becomes strongly coupled, which means that the Gino condensation should be taken into account on the hidden boundary, or on the result of the hidden boundary. And, well, the Gino condensation superpotential roughly goes like e to the plus t. It has the opposing behavior, opposing exponential behavior with respect to the orbifold length, which is our modulus t. So this gives rise to an attractive force between the boundaries. And, okay, here's just a picture of the superpotentials, which grow in exponential ways in opposite directions. At the end of the day, you have to work out the effective potential, of course, in order to check whether this leads to a minimum or not. And what you find is that indeed these two effects balance each other at some minimum. And, well, the next step is then, of course, so this was the story for the orbifold thing, the L modulus, or the T modulus. You can do similar things for the complex structure moduli or the volume modulus. So for the complex structure moduli, what we exploit is a certain perfect square type of the hydraulic action, which here in particular arises on the hidden boundary. And by this perfect square, you can balance the Gino condensate on the hidden boundary with a non-trivial H-flux. And since the H-flux is proportional to the holomorphic free form of the Calabi-Yau, it's capital omega, this in the end gives you a stabilization of the complex structure moduli. And now, for the stabilization of the volume modulus, well, you can propose a non-Kähler manifold. But what is probably simpler is you can take these amplitude instantons into account, of which we just spoke, and, well, they become important precisely of that reason, because the volume becomes small. So you can balance the amplitude instantons with the Gino condensation. This is sort of a racetrack mechanism. The amplitude instantons go like e to the minus s, whereas the Gino condensation has e to the minus s divided by the dual coxeter number of the hidden hidden gauge theory. So we have technically some sort of racetrack mechanism which balances these two guys, and that in the end leads to a stabilization of the volume modulus. Yeah.
You have a lovely picture there of what the effective potential looks like just when you balance an open M two-grade instantons against.
That's just the local situation,
right? So now there's two things to notice about this. The scale is incredibly tiny. Like these are cosmological constant sized. The other question is, doesn't the potential turn over?
Yeah, okay.
And so how are you sure cosmologically that it'll end up in this vacuum, for example, if it's falling down or whatever?
Oh,
that's the trouble with racetracks.
Oh, that question is huge.
Well, although there's a local up minimum, then it's a very, it's easy to jump over the part of the potential.
Well, okay. I just gave you the local picture because this wasn't supposed to be an overview. Actually, I also had a plot of the global behavior. The global behavior actually looks as usual, as you would expect. I mean, you have this decompactification towards infinity where the vacuum energy density goes towards zero, as you would expect on general grounds. Here, of course, you have to work. Well, it's a limit which is a little bit more intricate because you have this negative similarity. Maybe you would say, okay, let's stop there. But it turns out that the position of the negative singularity, it gets shifted towards infinity once I make the volume of the visible Calabi-Yau large. So when I go to the decompactification limit, I would like to make the Calabi-Yau volume large. So that shifts the position of the negative singularity as well towards infinity, and then you can study that regime, you can study the potential, and it goes away as usual, towards zero. And the other thing is about these values here. I don't have the transparency, but you can work out, of course, because it's F-transfer symmetry rating, you can work out the supersymmetry rating scale, that's no problem. And what you would find is that this is of the order of the, so the supersymmetricating scale is of the order of, well, it gives you the vacuum energy, it's the scale of the vacuum energy. So here, unfortunately, you wouldn't expect it anyway. I mean, you don't solve the cosmological constant problem here by getting vacuum energies which are millielectrons or 2^4. So this is not possible yet, and I would think that this requires some input from the quantum theory, definitely, but not just using the supergravity. So with the values for the vacuum energy, we get what you would usually expect. It's in the order of the supersymmetricating scale. I will actually have this on the next transparency. And yeah, with respect to your last question, how do we end up with that potential? Well, what we are right now doing is actually to study the whole potential landscape, which is quite weird, quite nasty. And then probably I can make better statements about that situation. So far, what we see is that this is actually very deep, very deep isolated potential here, because it goes down. I mean, these rises here exponentially, so it's very steep potential so far. But yeah, let me just mention. So the bottom line is that you get minima here, positive energy minima, which line a regime where the supergravity is under control, so where the involved volumes are large enough, sufficiently larger than one. Supersymmetry is broken spontaneously through F terms, which allow you to calculate crucial data like supersymmetry grading scale or equilibrium. And finally, the upshot is that whereas in the really coupled periodic string, there is this well-known runaway behavior for the dilaton. So remember the dilaton GS to the 2/3 is proportional to the orbifold thing. We found here a stabilization of L, in other words, the dilaton. So this runaway from the weakly coupled, which is here the weakly coupled, gets naturally stopped in the strongly coupled regime. Okay, so finally, one last experiment.
I didn't understand the important statement there. You said the supergravity control that the volumes are a lot larger than one. But I also thought you told us in the previous transparency that you set the volumes intentionally to be all around the gut scale, which was the fundamental scale of this problem.
Oh, this is, these are the Fonamengine parameters here, normalized in terms of intensity reduced, and there are additional factors of 2 pi and. It's a bit nasty. So these four-dimensional notation, these have to be bigger than one because they appear in the exponential. So you have for the open member instanton, e to the minus v ohm, for example. So v ohm is the volume of this open member instanton. And if that is of order one, then you would say, okay, now e to the minus 2 times v ohm, 3 times v ohm, so multiple wrapping modes will come in. And we don't have control over these. So therefore, here it's important that in this four-dimensional, from this normalization here, this VOM is sufficiently bigger than one so that we can forget about these multiple wrappings.
So is this some kind of statement that although the 11-dimensional supergravity is not under control because you have curvature fundamental scale, the four-dimensional effective supergravity theory is under control? Is that the thing?
In that regime where we're working, it's under control. Right. So where this minimum is located, so you can check that these values here are sufficiently bigger than one. And so that is.
But didn't
we
have
a
naked singularity in the 11 dimensions? You have a naked singularity.
Okay, I come to that on the next transparency.
Because you can't say that you know what you're doing if you haven't.
We stabilized the hidden boundary before reaching the naked singularity. And I will show you on the next transparency that this is possible.
But again, this is simply the four-dimensional supergravity in control, not the
five-dimensional. Right, this is the four-dimensional. Well, because we have included non-metric effects, we are forced to work in the four-dimensional framework. Otherwise, we'll be happy to continue in 11 dimensions, but this was just 4 dimensions. And actually, I should say that. In this framework, you are at 4 dimensions already below something like 10 to the 15 GQ. So, 4 dimensional effective supergravity has a large amount of validity. So, it's relatively huge amount of scale. So, let me, this is now the final transparency to the background information. So, do we learn about the hidden gauge group from this analysis? Well, for that, let me plot the stabilized module of the orbifold length L0, the critical length LC, which stays constant. Well, this is in certain units. Don't worry about the units. Then we have until the Suzy grading scale in TEV, so this is the third line here, depending on the hidden gauge theory. So we start with the hidden EAs and go down to the rank to something like the hidden SU3. I should say that the actual Suzy grading scale is M Suzy without the tilde, where we have left open this e to the kz, so this contribution from the compact structure for the regular potential. roughly speaking, this should be of the order of 1 divided by the visible boundary for rooms. So this is these units something like 1 divided by 300. So if you look at the volumes, then we see that for a hidden EA8, which is the usual, or was the usual setup for the Wiedekind hydraulic strain, long time, we see that the stabilized orbifold length is considerably smaller than the critical length. So this is bad news for the Newton's constant. At the same time, the Susy grading scale, well, divided by an addition of 300, that doesn't matter much, is way too large. It's 10 to the 10 TdV. But we see that once we go to smaller rank gauge groups on the hidden boundary, so L0 approaches LC, 7.1, 7.2, and at the same time, the Susy grading scale in TdV approaches the TdV regime if we divide by this addition of 300 here. So what we learn from all this is that in this strongly coupled framework, the hidden gauge group of rather small rank is favored. And again, we have some nice interplay between the particle physics and the gravity sectors. Can we, on the one hand side, once we go to these small gauge groups here, where the dual Coxeter number is, say, more than 3, it brings the Susy breaking scale close to the TdV regime. At the same time, it brings the orbifold length close to the critical value, where we know that this is good news for the four-dimensional Newton's constant. So once we break on the hidden boundary, the hidden EA is down to something smaller, like SU3, or it could be also possible of some hidden standard model. This has to be evaluated in a dynamical way, of course, in the end, how this cascade goes down. But the good news is that on this hidden boundary, once you break the hidden EA, of course, that you generate hidden matter. And a priori, this is, of course, a candidate for dark matter, because it interacts with the visible boundary only through gravitation. And well, you can expect that if, for example, on the hidden boundary, you have a hidden standard model theory, that the clustering of this hidden dark matter is similar to the clustering what you would expect from dark matter. Okay, so far for the background, and basically this is the situation into which we run way after inflation. So now I would like to change gears and go back to the early universe and come to inflation. So first, the usual approach to how to affect inflation in string theory is you select one modulus phi of these multitude of moduli which you have around, and you look at its potential by making sure that all the other directions in moduli space, all the other moduli are already stabilized at the beginning, so that you have effectively a potential which just depends on one flat direction, one flat modulus phi, which is then identified with the inflaton. So in order to make sure that this inflation has enough defoldings in order to be a realistic inflation, you have to check that both slow roll parameters, epsilon and eta, both the first and the second derivative of the potential, are sufficiently smaller than one. So typically, this first condition here is easy to get in supergravity. In fact, the supergravity theory is never also in string theory. Whereas the second constraint, the small parameter eta here, is a problem because typically it comes out of order one. So because the second derivative of the potential enters here, this problem of having this eta not small is synonymous to the inflaton mass problem, because the second derivative essentially gives you the mass of the inflaton phi. So there were a lot of proposals for the solution of this problem, but I think it's fair to say that when you look carefully at the situation, at least well, you can find it in this recent paper here, at least when you try in the end to stabilize the volume modulus, then this problem of eta of order 1 comes back. And so what we would like to do in the following is not to look into inflation, or not to try to embed inflation into string length theory by a single scalar model, but instead going to a multi-field inflation model. So to prepare some ground, let me first point out power law persistent inflation type mechanisms. So this is now purely in four-dimensional cosmology, we are not yet in M theory. So in order to embed inflation into string or M theory, there are various approaches. So you don't have to rely on new inflation. New inflation is well known, it's based on a vector energy dominated Bessel expansion where the scale factor grows exponentially. And many efforts have tried to embed inflation via this new inflation, also hybrid inflation, into string or M theory. For us, it will be important that there is another purely in four dimensions now, another type of inflation, which is called power law inflation. And power law inflation relies on an exponential potential, which is essentially determined just by this single parameter p here arising up below the root. So the interesting thing about this tolerant equation is that it leads to a very simple dynamics. Maybe you can solve exactly the Friedmann Robinson Walker, especially the third four-dimensional Friedmann Robinson Walker background. You can solve exactly the equations of motion of the Kaplan-Einstein scalar field system. And what you find is the power law behavior for the scale factor instead, so hence the name power law equation, where the singular parameter p determines the power, and you find an exact solution for the evolution of the inflaton phi. I should say that this solution is valid as long as p is bigger than 1/3, but inflation will only arise when p is bigger than 1, because only then you have an exaggerated universe, right? Or not if it's bigger than 0. This power law inflation, because essentially it's determined by just this one parameter p, it is very simple and constant, so long parameters, epsilon and eta, which are essentially just given by the inverse of this parameter p. Well, constant, first of all, means there's no exit from inflation. So once you have chosen this epsilon and eta to be small, then they will stay small and there's no exit, because an exit would mean that either epsilon or eta becomes a order 1. However, this is an approximate, I mean, for the purpose of embedding it through angular string theory, this is an approximate situation where you have this simple type of exponential potential. So typically what you get is, at some point, you get corrections to this simple exponential potential, which will then change, of course, your epsilon and eta and give an exit. Why we were interested, in particular, in this type of inflation was because the exponential potentials arise naturally, as you have seen, from various non-perturbative effects, and in the end, anyway, they have to be included for consistency, and they help for moduli stabilization, and for, in the end, give us spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. However, when we use e-break or membrane instantons, typically what we get is p, which is of order 1. So if you remember, this epsilon and eta were essentially 1 divided by p, t or 2 divided by p, then epsilon and eta are still of order 1, which is bad news. So just a simple power law inflation doesn't do the job yet. So the question is, what can we do instead to get inflation? And the answer is, well, we could use this method for this idea of assisted inflation, which was discovered in 1998 by these three people. And the essential idea is, well, instead of using just a single scalar field, which has this exponential potential, we will use n scalar fields instead, which have exactly this same exponential potential. And you can generalize this mechanism for various p's, but for our purposes, it's enough to have the same p for all of them. So the same parameter p of p is here, where for the purpose of embedding into M string theory, p is of order 1. So each of the individual exponential potentials here is distinct to give inflation on its own. However, because the dynamics of all of them is the same, you can just go by some simple rescaling, add this problem to the single field power law problem, and you find again an exact solution for this n scalar field dynamics. And the scalar factor turns out to be proportional to t to the p of n, where now this effective p is the original p, which is of order 1, multiplied by this capital N, so the number of scalar fields. And so even though originally the p was of order 1 and therefore too small to give rise to inflation, you can make this effective p easily large enough by adding a large enough of n scalar fields. So the question is then, this was purely four-dimensional cosmology, the question is then, can we embed this dynamics into N theory, and therefore making use of these two steep potentials, these exponential potentials? The mechanism is, we add them up, therefore we increase the Hubble friction, and that means by this increased Hubble friction, which each individual scalar sees, we go into the slower regime. So, for the embedding of this type of assisted respective power law inflation into M theory, we'll go again to heterotic M theory, which has in particular the virtue that eventually you would like to study reheating, and therefore it's necessary that you have a standard model or an extension of a standard model sector around, which here is naturally given by the Hubble boundary. So we would like to start with the following setup. Remember, before we had just the boundaries, the visible boundary and the hidden boundary, nothing at the bulk, but which is still supersymmetry preserving, is such a configuration of the pi frames which are parallel to the boundaries, we can place them all along the orbifold length. So all of these pi frames are supposed to fill four dimensional space time, and in order to preserve supersymmetry, they wrap one canonical between a zero holomorphic two cycle. And this picture already indicates that all these five grains are distributed along the orbifold length in an equidistant way. So now you can say, well, this looks pretty arbitrary. I mean, you can have a bunch of other distributions of these entire frames, of course, clustering at some point, the more dilute at other points. Well, actually, there's a good dynamical reason for having this distribution here. I will show it in the future transparency from now. So this distribution is actually the dynamically preferred one. Well, in any way, so let us start with this setup. So we have some M5 frames placed parallel to the boundaries in whatever manner along the orthogonal. And we would like to work out in the end the effective potential. Very simple. So we would have to deal with the moduli, the Taylor potential, and then the super potential. So the moduli comprise the compact structure moduli, the Clavier volume modulus S, the T modulus, which measures the orbifold length L. And then we have for each of these M5 frames an individual position field yi.
Can you have any N one field?
Any N what?
Any N number of 5 frames. Is that arbitrary?
Yep, no. Okay. This little index I runs from 1 to N, and I will tell you later on how constraints of N come about. There will be constraints on N, it's not arbitrary. And maybe you might expect, okay, it's a huge amount of arbitrariness that you can place whatever number of M5 frames you wish. There are constraints on that. But in something like 10 to 15 minutes from now.
Roughly how big can it be?
Well, it turns out that you can only get, on the one hand side, you can only get the simple exponential type of potential if we go to a certain regime in moduli space, which, okay, this proposes a certain inequality, and this inequality gives us an upper bound on the number of M5 frames. On the other hand, you have seen that the single parameter P here, well, it becomes this effective parameter P of N. This has to be bigger than 1. At P equals 1, you stop inflation. That's the exit from inflation. So P bigger than 1 in order to have inflation gives us a lower bound from the number of M5 frames. But for that, we really have to embed the M5 frame dynamics into the, we have to make the net change of the
dynamic. I just want to make my second question quick. You said that dynamically it's favored to have these at equal separations. Is that because of some entry frame instantons doing the repelling?
We will work out the effective potential, and from the effective potential you will see that it's positive definite, in particular in the Kähler-Kogerek derivatives. And when you set the Kähler-Kogerek derivative dw with respect to the five-frame position moduli equal to 0, in order to partially minimize the potential already, that geometrically gives you exactly the situation that in the large volume limit, that situation that all these environments have to be distributed equidistantly. So
that's
it comes from.
That's how you can get an assisted inflation because you have
the
same guys at the same separation. You wouldn't get that kind of magnification of heat if you didn't do that.
Well, if you would have. So you think of an arbitrary distribution first, and then you would ask how this evolves. Or
it's okay, I guess.
Well, we come to that in the next conference anyway. So, okay, now a little bit of definition and technique. So, these moduli, these complex moduli, S, T, and Y, I, so I runs from 1 to N for each of the five frames are defined like that. So the imaginary parts are the axioms. And what you see here is there's a calculation from the M5 frames on the bulk geometry, so therefore there's a piece in the volume behavior which depends on the back region of the M5 frames. The M5 frames will give you the kink in the bulk extension of the Clavier. So we, is the average Clavier volume averaged over the polyfold length, 3 ohm is the average volume of a 3-cycle of that form. And that is the length of the interval, and the xi11 are the positions of the individual and 5 frames among the orbifold. So it's useful to define these small parameters here. So small s, small t, small yi are always real. It's 2 times the real parts of the capital being all the complex moduli. And then we define a little y, which is the overall Euclidean length of the whole system of M5 frames. So furthermore, I would like to introduce this Q and R, and then we are done with the definitions. This Q and R are abbreviations for these combinations of S, T, and Ys. They are related to the Taylor potential, and they're very useful to express later on the full potential. And it turns out that both of them are positive, which will be crucial. Yeah.
Where did the naked singularity go? Is it still here?
Okay, yeah, actually want to say something.
And if so, on those N5 rings.
The naked singularity sits at some point in the bulk. And where we would like to start here is at where the Higgs boundary is very much closer to the visible boundary. So here in the early universe, we would like to start at a situation where the visible and the hidden boundary, where the hidden boundary is closer to the visible boundary than the distance to the naked singularity. So we start at some smaller L, and we will see that at the end of inflation, this L grows into the regime where the hidden boundary, gets strongly coupled, the geoquantization kicks in, and we have an induced H flux, and that stabilizes the orbifold length then. So that's the very end of inflation. Here, during the phase of inflation, we will assume that the hidden boundary is closer to the visible boundary, closer than the distance to the naked singularity.
The naked singularity is gone.
The naked singularity is outside, it's beyond the hidden boundary, and therefore it's so far it doesn't arise. It would arise as soon as the hidden boundary hits the position LC of the naked singularity. Then it would be within the, then it would reach, then it would come into the bulk.
And you're saying that there's, you know, the fact that you don't know how to resolve the singularity yet is irrelevant?
It would be, of course, relevant. I mean, if you enter that regime, and it will be relevant in the late stages, so nowadays.
Well, as long as you know what this thing has at the point of continuation, I suppose you're confident because you think of these as individual brains and
I mean, so far I'm confident because the phenomenology works in a very successful way, so there must be something about this. Of course, I would like to see the quantum theory of all this, definitely, no question about that. But it's very hard, of course. I mean, you have M theory in the bar, you would like to know what this thing is, the combination of M theory, then you have the boundaries condition. Yeah.
As far as the ball symmetric is concerned, do you treat the additional membranes as probes, or do you?
No. It's just including them, and you take the exact calculation. So I gave you this. Yes, that's exactly the solution for the ball geometry in the background.
Yeah.
And we have that all, I mean, that was the simplest case. We have that also present for the full back creation. You can place a five frames anywhere in the bulk. And
it doesn't change the position of the singularity?
It does. Yeah, okay, good point. Yeah, sure, it does. Because the five frames, depending on their charge, they contribute as well, will of course change the string behavior. But in the end, when it, okay, it's not here. You saw in the previous transparency that we start with a situation where we have five frames all over the interval. Yeah. At the end of inflation, okay, this is going ahead of the story. But these will repel each other due to the open membrane sometimes. So the five frames will move into the boundaries, and at the end, the bulk will become a five frame free. Mm-hmm. And so then you have the usual volume running, and then you have the singularity at some point. So if that's situation at the end of inflation, after inflation, you have the situation which I have described before. So during inflation, it won't be a problem.
You need to understand quantum scale physics to understand the Grace Lake. Is that what you're saying?
Not yet, not that I see it so far. Yeah. The graceful exit is actually, I will tell you, the graceful exit is actually takes place before you have actually reached the hidden boundary. But that's something I have to find out later on how the dynamics works towards the end of the equation. Maybe I can just first just try to do the mapping and then we come to that problem. So the Killer potential can be specified as usual. The interesting thing is that this contribution from the S modulus and the 5 grand position moduli can be expressed as minus ln of this entity Q, which I introduced earlier. So obviously Q has to be positive in order for the supergravity to make sense. You can also see from the fact that you can re-express Q as 2 times the average Kalamiyov motion, which should be positive in any case. So Q is a positive entity. Well, then we have these two other contributions, which are standard. An interesting observation is then that R also has to be positive. So that was the other entity which I introduced. And you can see this as follows. You can evaluate the determinant of the Kähler metric, and it comes out as, well, being proportional to this positive determinant here, the determinant of the metric on the complex structure moduli space. And all the other factors here, three factors here, are positive up to R. So in order to have a positive definite Kähler metric, this determinant should be positive, and therefore R should be positive. So therefore, in order to have a consistent theory of supergravity, both Q and both R should be positive. This will become important later on. So as far as the superpotentials are concerned, well, a priori we have contributions of open membrane stretching between both boundaries, between each of the M5 frames, between either boundary and M5 frame, score contributions.
So regardless of the volume of the Columbia out of the third year, what is the boundary? What is big R?
The big R. It was defined here. It's just a convenient abbreviation.
Oh, yeah.
I defined Q, I defined R. It's not related to the curvature. It's just two convenient abbreviations which pop up again and again in theta potential. And for us, it will be only essential that both of these quantities have to be positive, as I just shown. Otherwise, the supergravity wouldn't be under control. Okay, so, well, let me just do it in red because time is running fast. So we have the contributions of the open membrane in some terms between each of these five frames, the boundaries. Then in addition, a priori, we could have Gugino condensation. Now, Gugino condensation is only natural once the hidden boundary enters the regime where the volume would be sufficiently small. And this is not the case here, because we are supposing that we start at a situation where the hidden boundary is much closer to the visible boundary in the early universe. So therefore, the volume doesn't drop sufficiently such that the hidden boundary is already strongly cut off. So therefore, in this situation in the early universe, we don't have to take Gugino condensation into account. And Gugino condensation would ordinarily imply flux superpotential from the hidden boundary. We can also skip this for now. So we start at subcritical distances with the evolution. And the dominant piece of the open membrane instantons is, of course, the contribution from nearest neighbor and five frames. Well, just because these contributions, they go like into the minus, and the real part is just the volume over which these open membranes stretch. And so, well, obviously, the open membrane instantons, which stretch only between adjacent and five frames, this is the shortest volume or the smallest volume possible. So therefore, we focus here on the dominant contributions, which are given, or which result from nearest neighbor 5-5 and 5-5 open membrane instantons. So this is then our superpotential. Well, and then the rest, you can just plug it into the standard F-Fermi expression in order to determine the full potential for this situation. And we find at the end of the day this expression here, where you see once more that these Q and R pop up. Okay, so what you see is that, well, the first two terms are manifestly positive. For the second term, I remind that Q and R are both positive. So these are two positive terms. The third term, a priori, does not look like positive. So the second piece in the prefactor could be negative. However, it's rather easy to show that once Q and R are both positive, then this first factor has to be bigger than the second one, and therefore also this bracket has to be positive. So at the end of the day, what you get is a manifestly positive potential here. And this is, of course, a crucial prerequisite for getting inflation. So the next step will then be, in order to map the five-frame multi-five-frame dynamics to assisted inflation dynamics, to get rid of these first two terms. The first two terms were positive definite, and these two Kobe-Kehler covariant derivatives. So the first is with respect to the complex structure moduli, C alpha, and the second is with respect to the M5-frame position moduli, YI. So let me just point out what these two conditions imply. Obviously, they minimize partially the potential. These were the first two positive terms in the potential. So the first equation gives rise to H2,1 equations like this, for complex, fix the complex structure moduli. In particular, it applies a fixation of these far field, this prefactor in front of the open membrane instantons, because this depends on the complex structure moduli, and they are fixed by these equations. So at the end of the day, there's a fixation of this prefactor as well. The second equation, so the vanishing of the Kehler covariant derivative with respect to the M5-frame position moduli, the capital YI fields. In the large volume limit, this Kehler covariant derivative can be split. Of course, this is exact to these two pieces, the partial derivative and some extra piece. And in the large volume limit, this is suppressed against this one here. So the Kehler covariant derivative becomes just the partial derivative. And, well, everything done with a partial derivative and setting it equal to zero on the nearest neighbor five-band contributions, what we get is that all the distances between the nearest neighbor and five frames have to be equal. So this is the picture which I had at the beginning, and you see here that it comes from this partial minimization of the potential. Okay, so what we are left over with is then the third term. The third term looked like this. So we have this prefactor. We had shown already that the prefactor is positive once the zeta gravity is under control. However, what bothers us still is we would like to identify, because all in the end we would like to map this dynamics to the dynamics of a system inflation, we would like to identify essentially the nearest neighbor distances between the M5 frames with the inflaton. So then the nearest neighbor difference between the M5 frames also pops up here in this Y in front of these exponential factors, and so this is not precisely what we would like to have. This is not of the type which we would need for system inflation. So the question is, can we get rid of the second term here and just need the first term? Well, the thing is that consistent with the large volume limit, we can impose the following inequality. So we can, first of all, impose this inequality here, which is consistent with a large volume limit, because the Q in the large volume limit just becomes S, essentially the Clavier volume, the average Clavier volume. And this is anyway to be, has to be much, much bigger than 1, otherwise we would run out of the regime probability. You see already at this point, the Y grows, of course, with N, because it sums over all the contributions of the five-frame position. So the Y grows with N, so in other words, we'll say more about this later on, this imposes an upper bound on the number of five frames, this equation here. So you see that this inequality here comes in because we would like to simplify the potential and just allowing us just to keep this first term here and neglect the second term. This is exactly what happens when you have this inequality. Then you can show that the second term is much, much smaller than the first term. So we lose this one. And, well, then we have just the distances between our five frames, which we'd like to identify with the inflaton. We just have it in the exponential. And there's nothing, since this contribution is small, there's no contribution to the prefactor. So this is just what we would like to get in the end. But it was, of course, crucial to see that this inequality is compatible with a large volume regime. So we then end up with this simple type of potential, which when we express in terms of this delta y, which is 2 times the real part of the difference between nearest neighbor five frames. So the potential looks like this, which has the required form that the inflaton or the delta y just appears, only appears in the exponential and not in some other form. Well, so the next 2 steps are rather trivial, so I can just describe them in words. So next what you have to do is you have to map this candidate for the inflaton, you have to map it to a canonically normalized scalar, since the kinetic term of the y's is of course not canonically normalized. There's a non-trivial Taylor metric contribution. Well, okay, this is a real story, so you go to canonically normalized fields instead, which means that you have to go from these yi's to the phi i's, or the difference is delta y to the delta phi. Next, there's the observation that the center of mass position of all the five frames doesn't receive a potential. It gets not shifted, it stays constant, the kinetic term vanishes. So there's only a potential for the distances between each and five frames, but for the center of, for the combined center of mass coordinate. So therefore, it's more appropriate to now switch to the center of mass and the relative coordinates by using these normalized phi i's while going to the center of mass coordinate. And there's an easy dictionary between the individual five-frame position, now canonically normalized and five-frame position multiply, the center of mass coordinate, and the relative distance between two and five frames. So we switch to these coordinates, and the observation is then that the center of mass coordinate, its kinetic term vanishes, it just stays constant. There's only a natural kinetic term for the delta phi. So once we do this additional step, which implies a second renormalization, then at the end of the day, we have to switch once more from these delta phi's to the now canonically normalized phi's, So this is now identified with our interton, and it's, of course, as you could expect, proportional to the differences between the entire frames. So there's this proportionality constant. So the potential in terms of the canonically normalized scalar phi interton looks like this. And what you see is that, well, okay, this is the square root, and you might remember that we had initially for this power law or system type of inflation, we had the square root when it was 2 divided by p. So we can now identify the anterior parameters with the effective four-dimensional cosmology parameters. And yeah, just really, and then adopt the spatially fed four-dimensional Morgan reverse background. And with this type of a potential and the usual scalar field equation, you end up exactly at the dynamics which is used for, or which is required for power law inflation.
What is little t?
Little t is the real part, or little t is capital T plus capital T bar.
So that is that's not a constant then, that's in front of phi.
Yeah, I come to that.
So you're wanting to have a weekly time dependent or something? So
right. Okay, that's jumping ahead, but yeah, I come to that in a moment. During, well, the short answer is that during this type of inflation, where you run down exponential steep directions, these in the t direction, on the s direction, these have just the power law run away, so these are essentially constant over that period where we run down these exponential steep directions. Okay, so the mapping to assisted inflation, we have this potential, so the mapping is then done by identifying the effective four-dimensional parameters p at the scale of inflation with the n-theory parameters here, particularly as the number of the five trains. And the interesting thing is, well, the theta problem was basically that the p was of order 1, it couldn't be made too large. What you see here is that, well, with the five trains being present, you have essentially a large n, you have essentially something which is n cubed, and so therefore it's not too hard to make p large. Of course, we have to check whether the constraints which we have imposed are still satisfied. So let me then come, okay, so this completes the mapping to assisted inflation and the identification with the assisted power law inflation parameters p and p naught. So next we have the question, or we have to ask the bounds of n. So is there some non-trivial n which satisfies these constraints? So first of all, we have the condition, you might remember, so this qt has to be much, much bigger than y squared. And because the y grows with n, this obviously gives an upper bound on n, so n cannot be too large, otherwise this would be stalled. And once you choose typical values in this regime where we started for s and t, this amounts to something like n has to be smaller than 200. On the other hand side, so this was a condition which simplified the potential in order to come up with the assisted type of inflation dynamics. On the other hand side, we have a second constraint, or we do have a second constraint now, since we would like to get inflation, which means the p should be bigger than 1, well, we can use this identification over here. And so this means that essentially 4 times n cubed has to be bigger than this thing here, which when taking again these values here, gives us a lower bound on n, which is roughly something like 20. So what we find then is that there's a non-trivial interval. So a non-trivial set of n's which satisfy both of these constraints, essentially the n's have to be between 20 and much smaller than 200. The interesting thing is, I will mention it later on, that you can evaluate the number of e-foldings and even the scalar spectral index because that is very simple for power law inflation, and you find that these require as well an n within this regime. So this is quite non-trivial to see that these are not without the regime, lying without the regime of validity. Okay, so another comment on moduli stabilization. There's a crucial difference between this approach, how to embed inflation into M theory, and usual approaches. In the usual approach, you would think about one flat direction, and of course you have to stabilize before inflation all the other directions. Otherwise, well, the universe would just fall down some steeper direction and would spoil the mechanism. Well, here we did just the opposite. Here we used, we didn't try to fabricate a very small or very flat potential. What we used were the steepest potentials which were available at that time in the early universe, so the exponentially steep directions, which per se individually do not give rise to inflation. But when you combine them, so I actually had to should have drawn here many, many n of these exponentially decreasing lines. So when you add many of them, this was the assisted mechanism, assisted type of inflation mechanism. When you add many of them, the Hubble friction increases and you get inflation. So at the end of the day, this means that the universe during inflation will slow these very steep directions. And for example, the runaway and the S on the T direction. So in particular, we don't want to stabilize the T modulus at that point. But that runaway in the T direction is just a 1 over T runaway, which is much milder than an exponential runaway. So that means that during that type of, during the inflationary period, these other scalars would essentially stay constant, so that it's not a big problem at that point. So in particular, the philosophy here is a different one. I mean, here, well, we have stabilized the compact structure moduli, but it alleviates considerably the problem to stabilize all the moduli up to 1 before inflation.
So T is stabilized
pre-inflation? T is stabilized after inflation. T is related. T is essentially the
index,
normal length.
The index P is rolling around or something.
Okay, the index P...
it goes like 1 over T. It goes like
yeah, but the SMT during inflation... Okay, the picture is as follows. You have the boundary, visible and hidden. So during the initial time, during the early universe, these are 5 brains, basically they explode, they repel each other very quickly because they are very close, so the interaction is just dominated by their contributions. Whereas the interaction with respect to the boundaries is exponentially negligible because those open membranes have to stretch over far longer distances. The T modulus will grow once the distance between the 5 brains have reached an order of magnitude which is comparable to the length between the boundaries. Then you have to take into account all the other open membrane instantons, and that will lead to an increase, again, the repulsion of the boundaries. The open membrane instantons can only lead to a repulsion. So, therefore, at this late stage, when inflation ends, it actually ends before that, but at this late stage, when the boundaries will repel each other, and then you run into the regime where these boundaries become strongly coupled, you have H normalization, H flux, so you have all the contributions which stabilize then the volumes, S and T, in late stages after inflation. Okay, so concerning the number of M5 brains, well, so far we have kept the number of M5 brains fixed, but at some point, the M5 brains will of course hit the boundaries, then just coalesce with the boundaries, and that means if you look at the symmetric situation, that will jump from n to n minus 2 to n minus 4 and so on. So you can also see this from the anomaly cancellation equation where all these betas are 3 betas of h characterize the topological data on the boundaries, visible and hidden boundary, and the n is the number of M5 brains. So once these boundaries coalesce with the boundaries, the topological data of the boundaries will change, causing the number of M5 planes to change as well. So all in all, what we have is essentially some sort of cascade-like inflation. So the number of M5 planes evolves as follows. You start with some number of M5 planes, and within this regime, it's n^200. And then you evolve down from n to n minus 2, n minus 4, and so on, and so on. And the exit from inflation will be given by this condition, that the effective P, which depends on the number of M5 planes at that Q phase, has to be, when that becomes 1, then you have this exit from inflation, that inflation will definitely stop. So for each of these phases here, we can go back to the initial derivation and we will come up with the power law inflation. Well, because this second constraint which we had imposed, it will just become better and better satisfied. Since once we shrink or once we decrease with the number of M5 planes, Y depends or increases with N, but if N becomes smaller, the Y decreases. So this condition once satisfied for the initial situation by having the number of M5 planes between 20 and 200, it becomes better and better satisfied later on. So we will have this sort of cascade inflation where you start over here at each of these phases, one of these power law inflations, with a different power, of course, power changes, because it depends on the number of M5 planes. Well, then we have to match these solutions at these transition times, TQ. So this can be done, and gives you this formula over here. And to give you one last result at the end, let me come to the number of e-foldings at least. So the number of e-foldings are defined as usual. We take the logarithm of the scale factor at the final time over the initial time, and with the formula which I have just given you on the previous instance, you can express this in terms of the logarithms of the ratios of these transition times. So when pq factor in front is just the effective p determined in terms of the n number of m5 brains present at the q phase. So the question is then, can we determine these ratios of the transition times? Yes, we can. What we use for that is just the exact solution for the inflaton. So that was possible. Our log calculation gave an exact solution for the inflaton, so we can just grab that solution. In other words, we have the t, the transition times, expressed in terms of the inflaton, and the inflaton was nothing else but the distance between the M5 frames. So this can be re-expressed because it's divided here by the orbifold length, just in terms of the number of M5 frames, because it's the transition times here. So in those times, it's just, you have this simple relation here. So the question is then, can we sum up this, this series? Yes, we can. The thing is, we have to specify initially some S or T for this initial period. This three-factor unit tilde will drop out because we only have to take these ratios. One of them, we just need an exit. We need to know when to stop this summation. And the exit is given, by this condition once more, which means that the N has to be of order 20, the lower bound, of course. We saw that already before. So we have to sum this up, stop at that point, and that determines then we plug it in into the formula for the number of e-foldings, and what we get at the end of the day is the following table. So the number of M5 frames is given here on the left, 40, 50, up to 70, and that gives rise to these number of e-foldings on the right-hand side. So you remember we had to be within this window for the ends. We see that a realistic number of M5 frames, which is supposed to lie between 50 and 60, can also be obtained within this regime. So that is, of course, crucial. If it would lie outside the regime, or it would have just a number of e-foldings which is smaller than 10, then we could say we forget about this proposal. So the conclusion is that this type of inflation, which I would like to call cascade inflation, offers a very direct way to address this eta problem, because for this type of inflation, the eta, epsilon as well, but the eta is just given by the inverse of this effective p, and by having a large amount of n sub m5 frames, this is a very direct way to make the p large by this assisted inflation mechanism. Second, you see that we can account for a realistic number of e-foldings in the regime where this derivation holds true. Finally, I should say that it's very interesting to study these small inflaton phase transitions because, first of all, obviously, they are important for reheating and they will collide with the visible boundary. And then it's the question whether they could lead to cosmic spins as well. So far, cannot give conclusive answers on both, but this is definitely interesting to study in the following. Thanks.
Well, we've already had a lot of questions, but maybe we'll take one or two more. All right.
Isn't your command on the number of peoples, this famous 50 or 6, strongly connected to the theory of the fluctuations of your scalar fields? And this theory you don't have, you didn't quantize your function.
Are you speaking about the scalar spectral index?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something I'm just right now working on. I would completely agree that it's what we did was we used the usual power law inflation expression where this n minus 1 is given by 1 divided by p, so you need some p which is of order 100, and we can get it rather easily because the p is basically n cubed. So it's by modest numbers of n, so you can achieve large p's. So that worked fine. Of course, I agree completely that. Because it's not just four dimensional cosmology, you have to reconsider that thing completely. This is one thing which you're trying to do actually right now.
Well, it would be interesting to have the power spectrum of this.
Sure.
Is there any idea about that ultimate vacuum state of the theory here around which this five fluctuates? Is there any proposal?
Not that I know of so far, not in this context, no. I think we have really to work from scratch as far as I can see it is. I wouldn't like to rely on all the results, which are definitely not in this framework. It
might be difficult because Hamiltonian is time dependent, so there's a lot of arbitrariness.
Because what is?
The Hamiltonian is time dependent.
Yeah, okay.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Axel again.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing.